Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I made my radio debut at the age of 13, taking the bus from Clonskee to O'Connell Street and entering RTE wearing a pink mantilla. Back then, Ireland's public broadcaster addressed the nation from the upper floors of the GPO, while below, in the central hall, people swirled around Oliver Shepherd's statue of Cuchulainn, queuing to send telegrams or buy a tuppenny stamp. It was 1960s Dublin, when mantillas were worn by women who'd moved on from hats and abandoned headscarves, but weren't bold enough to enter a church with uncovered hair. Hats were still worn by people's mothers. Headscarves, if tied on rather than under the chin, had flair, but nothing beat a nylon triangle over a back-combed hairdo for bringing a touch of the dance of the Seven Veils to 10 o'clock mass. Like Ford's Model T motor car, Dubliners' mantillas came in any colour so long as it was black. This didn't bother my elder sisters. There was much to be said for looking like a sultry senorita, or Jackie Kennedy as a romantic widow, or Grace Kelly when she became a sexy princess. But those roles weren't considered suitable for children. So, until I was 10, I went to mass in a blue school beret, pulled down firmly over my ears. Then, as I entered my teens, Ireland entered a decade of social upheaval, when the Beatles ousted the Clancy brothers, garlic was sold in Duke Street, and in our house, hell broke loose in the mantilla department. My sister Anne went to the States, came back with all kinds of notions, and presented me with a bright pink mantilla with scalloped edges. I was forbidden to wear it anywhere near a church, but no one could stop me using it to tie up my ponytail when a producer, known to my aunt, wanted a young person's angle in a radio magazine programme. I was terrified and had nothing to say, but I'll never forget the empowerment that came with that flash of pink lace as I walked into the studio. Progress in 20th century Ireland took its own winding roads. We had national radio broadcasts in the 1920s, way ahead of the populations of most European countries, but De Valera was wary of television, so we didn't get our own TV station till the 1960s. The grainy black and white images felt super sophisticated, like Mary Quant's up-art dresses. But few families could afford to buy a TV set, and besides, we were still hooked to sound. Radio Luxembourg on a transistor under the bedclothes was a teenage rite of passage. We sat round the radiogram for the top 10 every week, ate dinner with the Kennedys of Castle Ross in the background, and analysed agony aunt Frankie Byrne's listeners' letters. And in the 1960s, proving Ireland was still right there at the front of the pack, Ronan O'Rahilly, grandson of the O'Rahilly, one of the heroes of 1916, had started broadcasting pop from a pirate ship in unlicensed waters. I was just 17 when I went to college. Only a few years earlier, girls who studied at UCD had been forbidden to wear trousers. In the new Belfield campus, we wore cheesecloth tops over patched jeans, platform clogs, plunging necklines and trailing maxi dresses. I toured the Gaeltachtaí in a van with a bunch of other students, performing versions of avant-garde works we'd translated to Irish, alongside one act by Johnny Colvike, a Connemara man whose plays had proper beginnings, middles and endings. Then, in mid-1970s London, where I'd gone to train as an actress, I wrote scripts for the BBC, cunningly peppered with chunks of Irish, a strategy that ensured I was hired to be in them. That strategy kick-started a radio career that in the beginning felt surreal. At one point, I was cast opposite Patrick McGee, the fearsome actor for whom Beckett had written Crap's Last Tape. McGee was playing in Dr. Faustus in the West End at the time, having previously triumphed as the Marquis de Sade in the Royal Shakespeare Company's Marat Sade. The night before our studio day, I went to see him in Faustus and was so overawed that the following morning I thought of calling in sick. But among the clothes I'd packed in my rucksack to take to London was a black velvet dress from the Basement Boutique just off Suffolk Street in Dublin. And the week before I saw Faustus, I'd gone mad in the King's Road and bought a pair of ridiculous pink cowboy boots in a sale. So I wore the boots with the Dublin dress, shortened by then from a maxi to a midi, and just as the pink mantilla had carried me into the GPO, a ridiculous flash of pink carried me into Broadcasting House and up to the studio on a wave of empowerment.
On the night of the 18th of June, 1963, my siblings and I gathered round the old Mullard valve radio in the kitchen of our house in Stonybatter. The British heavyweight champion at the time, Henry Cooper, or our hero Henry, as he was known to his Cockney fans, was facing a young American, Cassius Clay, at Wembley Stadium, who had rather cockily predicted that he would beat Cooper in five rounds. Over a crackly BBC signal, an excited Harry Carpenter set the scene for a memorable fight. I was 11. My elder brothers, Sean and Matt, had instilled in us a love of heavyweight boxing, which they'd received from our late father, himself in his youth an accomplished amateur. We could barely hear Harry's voice above the din of 50,000 fans, every one of whom, it seemed, was shouting for Cooper. We listened with amazement as Carpenter described Clay entering the ring with a fake crown on his head, proclaiming himself to be the king and the greatest. The bell sounded, and Cooper, who possessed the best left hook in the game, stalked Cassius for the first two rounds, catching him regularly. Clay's response was to tease Cooper by dropping his guard and inviting him to come forward. Cooper had very sharp bone structure, especially above his eyes, which meant that he cut very easy. Clay's manager, Angelo Dundee, had told Clay to exploit this. By the start of round four, Cooper's eye was bleeding profusely. It was clear that he could not continue much longer. Then, out of nowhere, came the famous left hook, and Clay was on the canvas. The bell went after 2 seconds, and he was helped to his corner. Harry Carpenter was screaming above the crowd. Clay doesn't know where he is. The regular 60 seconds break was extended by the timekeeper to 65 seconds, clearly to the annoyance of the packed arena. But Clay came out and kept fighting. Round five, just as he predicted, ended when the referee stopped the fight, with Carpenter proclaiming Cooper's injury the worst eye cut he had ever seen. Clay's prize for winning in Wembley was a match with the then world champion Sonny Liston, whom he knocked out in the first round, and so began the reign of the greatest fighter the world's ever known. My brothers and sisters and I would follow his career for decades, and like millions of people worldwide, learn not just to admire him as a great fighter, but also as a great human being, a civil rights advocate who gave a voice and hope to African Americans suffering under bitter racism. Little did I know that night in 1963 that 10 years later I would meet my hero, Muhammad Ali, as he would later be known. In the early 1970s, I was lucky enough to get a job as a trainee sound engineer in Avondale's studio. My duties included spinning discs and making tea for Larry Gogan and Gay Byrne, Jimmy McGee, Mike Murphy, Val Joyce and other broadcasters at the time. I have great memories of Larry Gogan arriving with a box of discs under his arm and always a smile on his face. His timing was impeccable. And of course, there was the golden voice that was his trademark. Around this time, Muhammad Ali, at the pinnacle of his career, had been stripped of his title for refusing to serve in Vietnam. He was also refused a license to fight in the US, and because of that, a fight was arranged for Dublin, which would see Ali face a little-known boxer called Al Blue Lewis. A call came through to Avondale's studio asking us to record a radio ad with Ali to promote the fight. As Ali was busy training, someone would have to go to record him on location. You can imagine my mixture of horror and delight when Chief Engineer Paddy Gibbons handed me a TC-800 reel-to-reel tape recorder and a Grampian microphone and dispatched me to Croke Park to record one of the most famous people in the world. The fact that this will be my first ever location recording didn't help. When I arrived, I was sent to the handball alley at the back of the old Cusick stand. It was like entering a set from a 1940s movie, a smoke-filled room packed with press, camera crews, cut men, sparring partners and hangers-on. Ali was sparring with a punch bag held by his manager, Angelo Dundee. I was told to wait until they had finished. At last, I was called to the ringside. I then experienced a phenomenon that I'm sure I never will again. It was a blast of physical, tangible, powerful energy that was almost overpowering, yet radiating peace and happiness at the same time. It was like being in the presence of a colossal Greek god. I pressed record, praying that everything was in order. I had to stretch to get the mic near to him. I handed him the piece of paper with the script on it. He paused to read it, then looked at me with that well-known Muhammad Ali wry smile and stare. "You ready?" he said. "I'm going to float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. The Evening Herald is the paper for me. It's the greatest." And the greatest is what he was.
For over a week, TV continuity announcers were telling viewers that the 1973 general election results programme would be in colour for the first time. I asked my mam, does that mean people like us who still had a black and white set would get different election results? I'm 14. I like being a smart aleck. I live in one channel and so on results day, there's nothing else on TV anyway, in colour or black and white. Mr. Crow had told us to watch the programme and write a composition about proportional representation. I'm trying to think of a different way to write it, something a bit weirder, when my mam comes in and stands staring at the telly. What's Brian Farrell done to his hair? Oh, there's Professor Basil Chubb. He's very clever. What's he saying? What Professor Basil Chubb is saying is that it's going to be a very long night and voter preferences will be vital in determining the final outcome. My mam says, he really knows the ins and outs of the whole thing. I could listen to him all day. And then she goes upstairs and I hear the sound of the Hoover. Suddenly, I have my big idea for the composition. It will be all about PR, but never mention PR. In capital letters, I write, "The Election Restaurant." I'm excited now. And as it happens, so is Professor Basil Chubb, because a first count result has come in from Roscommon Leitrim. And amazingly, Brian Lenehan, one of the government's best-known faces and a minister for over 10 years, might be about to lose his seat. "It all depends on the order of eliminations," says Professor Basil Chubb. Is he English, or is that just the way they talk in Trinity College? I begin. Mr. V was feeling hungry, so he went to eat in the election restaurant. He read the menu carefully. I'm confident that my English teacher, Mr. Crow, will spot that V is for voter and the menu is a metaphor. Mr. Crow is always going on about metaphors. "Plenty of choice on this menu," taught Mr. V, even though he knew already what his first choice would be. I stop, scratch out choice and write in preference. Mr. V's first preference would be a juicy cheeseburger. The waiter took his order and went to the kitchen, but was back in seconds and said, "Sorry, but they were out of cheeseburgers." In fact, cheeseburgers had been eliminated from the menu. Was there anything else he fancied? Mr. V sighed and thought about it. Then he asked for his second preference, fish and chips. On the telly, Brian Farrell seems delighted to congratulate Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald on his impressive result, elected on the first count miles over the quota. Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald is very modest. Oh, most important is that his surplus will help his running mate win the final seat. My mam comes in all excited because she'd heard Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald's distinctive voice. He's brilliant, the way he wipes the floor with that Fianna Fáil crowd every time. And an absolute gentleman. How is he able to talk so fast and not trip up? The waiter was all apologies, tripping over his words. Awful sorry. There was a surplus of fish and chips and now there's none. Very embarrassing. Maybe Mr. V had a third preference. Mr. V was getting annoyed now. You try to make a complete idiot out of me. Is there any food in this restaurant at all? Oh, definitely, sir, definitely. You can have pizza or a chicken curry or bacon and cabbage. Mr. V noticed another waiter arrive at a nearby table with two decent-looking pizzas and he thought, OK, maybe pizza as a third preference. But then he heard, "You're lucky, folks. You got the last two pizzas." I stop writing when I hear Brian Farrell say, "Charles J. Haughey." Then he says, "Conor Cruz O'Brien." Now I'm really interested. Everyone knows these two TDs can't stand each other because of the arms trial, a thing that happened way back when I was only 11 and wasn't paying any attention to politics. The returning officer for Dublin North East looks very nervous because he knows he's on live television.
"Haughey, Charles James, 12,901.
Whoops and cheers as he's lifted up onto shoulders and bounced up and down.
"O'Brien, Conor Cruz, 7,854.
No one hoists him on their shoulders. It seems to me Brian Farrell has the merest smile on his face as he asks Conor Cruz if he'd like to congratulate Mr. Haughey on his enormous vote of nearly 13,000. There's a pause. Then Conor Cruz says,
"However the people in their wisdom express a preference for are all worthy of congratulation."
From the tone of his voice, I wonder if, secretly, Conor Cruz thinks the voters had very little wisdom at all. At this stage, Mr. V had no preference for anything that was left on the menu. He didn't care for chicken curry. But on the other hand, he really hated bacon and cabbage. So reluctantly, he chose curry. Mr. V was fairly certain he would be hungry and dissatisfied again very soon. The election restaurant had seemed to offer lots of good things. But in the end, people got very little nourishment. It's 1 a.m. now, and Brian Farrell is asking Professor Basil Chubb to call the 1973 election. Professor Basil Chubb says, "As it seems certain now that Brian Leonard will lose his seat in Roscommon Leitrim, I predict a win for the coalition." 14-year-old smart aleck me is thinking, sure, a shiny new government, but everything will still look the same on our black and white telly. However, as I write the end and read back over my composition, hoping it will amuse Mr. Crow, I begin to realise something. If I can get the words right, maybe I can create my own colour.
When I tell people that I grew up in the 60s and 70s in a house with no books, no television until I was 15,
little access to newspapers, and none at all to theatre or travel, they look at me with pity, flinching from the barrenness of a life bereft of cultural enrichment. When I tell them that that upbringing was the richest imaginable, the look turns to disbelief. I suffered no deprivation of imagination or intellect as I was growing up, thanks largely to our magic box, the wireless. Saturday mornings brought the enchantment of Peter, Paul and Mary and their song Puff the Magic Dragon. The lyrics filled my uncluttered imagination with wondrous images of Puff and his little companion, Jackie Paper. I travelled with them on a boat with billowed sail, winning the hearts of noble kings and princes and the respect of pirates. This song is so embedded in my heart that I've instructed its inclusion in any funeral rite organised to see me out of town. While I was fascinated by Puff the Magic Dragon, my father was strangely fascinated by another item on the wireless, the missing persons announcements at the end of the lunchtime news. My father would signal the house to silence as reliable newscasters like Charles Mitchell or Maurice O'Doherty read out the details of people who'd gone astray, whereabouts unknown. The descriptions were always vivid, conjuring up images of poor people who might be suffering from memory loss, last seen wearing a Fair Isle jumper or a housecoat and slippers, as they were spotted boarding some country-bound bus at Bus Oris. While my mother and I listened with interest, my father listened with the forensic intent of a detective. He kept a jotter and the stub of a pencil on top of the wireless to record the details in case he might happen on one of the lost people. Another group frequently mentioned in that solemn broadcast were honeymooners or holidaymakers, usually touring Kerry in a grey Anglia or black Morris Minor, asked to contact home for an urgent message. My father transcribed the number plates in his jotter. Such announcements stopped us in our tracks as we speculated about every sudden affliction that might have befallen some stranger's family. Just as I had tearfully empathised with Puff the Magic Dragon as a child, I empathised too with those people who were to hear of something calamitous. I don't believe that my father ever had to hail down a vehicle, or indeed that he spotted any of the missing people getting off the bus in Castle Street. But his daily attention to this news item was a vicarious, dramatic engagement with the lives of others. My mother enjoyed the radio too, especially the sponsored programmes broadcast at lunchtime or dinner time, as it was in our house. The Jacob's Biscuit one was a firm favourite. Frankie Byrne's sultry voice smouldered around our kitchen as she dispensed advice on affairs of the heart. As my mother sat listening with her mug of tea and cigarette, this programme afforded her all the satisfaction of a night at the theatre as she contemplated the intricacies of others' lives. Once, my mother's name was read out on the radio and we almost choked on the Golden Wonders with the excitement. Uncharacteristically, she had written to RTE, not a letter to Frankie about a romantic issue, but an inquiry to the homely couple Tom and Peggy at the Fruitfield help desk. This down-to-earth, chatty pair were the dispensers of household tips. My mother, a great gardener, had declared herself tired of the blousy blue hydrangea flowers and longed to turn the blooms, the rusty red she admired in other gardens. Tom and Peggy's discussion about acidic and alkaline soil went over our heads, but my mother did manage to jot down the basics on her cigarette packet. Wood ash or lime would do the trick, they said, and no gardener in Kew was more proud than my mother when she followed the advice, and a few of the blooms did indeed reward her with rusty red petals. We didn't have books or films or plays or foreign travel when I was growing up, but I journeyed every Saturday morning with Puff the Magic Dragon to his land called Honalee. My father looked out for missing people and imagined all the drama that might surround them. My mother became a magician who could turn blue flowers a stunning shade of red.
Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honalee.
I never knew the eminent psychiatrist R.D. Lang. I don't know what he did before or after his famous appearance on The Late Late Show, but as a 15-year-old, I was gripped. I'd no idea what a fourth wall looked like, but when Gayburn broke it by asking the question, we were all thinking about just what this guest had had to drink before coming on his show. The heated discussion which followed became one of the standout TV moments of my childhood. I was an only child. That probably explains a lot. In the bathroom mirror of our house in Newry, I used to interview myself on The Late Late. Well, Gay, that's a great question. I imagined a future where the details of my fascinating life and glittering career would have a national audience glued to their seats on a Friday night, because it was the biggest show in town. I envied Gay sitting at his desk in front of a succession of storytellers like the great actor Peter Ustinov recounting a long and winding story, including a perfectly observed, detailed impersonation of a Ukrainian railway official. Neil Tobin effortlessly slipping from county to county poking fun at the Cork men and the Cavan men and the Nordies. Billy Connolly like a bold child. The red-faced audience member in his best beige jacket jabbing a finger towards the presenter, raging about the declining moral standards in Ireland. And behind him, Bridie from Ballymahon, the pride of the parish, waving to everybody at home, beside herself to be on The Late Late Show at last. And straight after the show, you knew Bridie would be loading the goodies into her Toyota Starlet to head for home. One for everybody in the audience. Enfant terrible, Bob Geldof, Ferdy McKenna, Grumpy Old Men, Hugh Leonard, Ulick O'Connor, Dublin Can Be Heaven, A Pint of Plain, Soap Your Arse and Slide Backwards Up a Rainbow, and off to bed. The Late Late was the conversational currency of our weekends. Then I moved to Belfast, a bit further out of reach of RTE. And one night, I came to realise that not everyone was aware of this extraordinary phenomenon. I presented a concert which went out live on BBC Radio 3. The Ulster Orchestra was conducted by a brilliant Kerry man called Robert Houlihan. Just before the final piece, my producer said, go out on stage and fill with Bobby for 2 minutes or so. Bobby was delighted to get the chance to chat and enthusiastically began to plug his new series of CDs to a packed house in the Ulster Hall. Now, I was conscious that this was going out right across the UK and that listeners in Chipping Norton or Clonethly mightn't be as interested, and the BBC bosses certainly wouldn't want to hear a shameless, if entertaining, plug for Bobby's latest commercial venture. So in an attempt to draw the conversation to a close, I said, wow, Bobby, sounds like you've a car boot full of CDs up in Belfast with you tonight. Sure there's one for everybody in the audience. Bobby laughed, I laughed, and said, so let's hear the final piece. It's the Hungarian Dance No. 1 by Brahms, the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Robert Houlihan. They played, he conducted, we got the programme over the line and handed back to Broadcasting House in London. Job done. As the audience slipped away into the chilly Belfast night and the musicians and crew were packing up, someone said, there's a lady wants to talk to you there at the front of the stage. And there, sure enough, was a small delegation of women with good coats on. We really loved the show, they began, particularly the concerto. Oh, thanks very much, says I. We were just wondering, where do we pick up the CDs? The CDs, I said. Yes, you said there was a CD for everybody in the audience. Oh, I did, yes, that's right. That was, you see, there's this TV show called The Late Late Show. They continued to smile in their buttoned-up coats. On RTE, presented by Gay Byrne, not a flicker. And every week he gives away stuff like hampers or holidays to the audience. It's like a catchphrase, you know, one for everybody in the audience. So there's no CDs. By the time I'd said, no, sorry, that's my fault, it's a misunderstanding, they had thanked me and were out the door. Gay Byrne's charm and that unique Late Late Show mix of entertainment and controversy mightn't have had people talking in quite every corner of Ireland. But for those of us in the know, we knew. Thanks, Gay.
My friends, please hear me do. I've got a message just for you.
It was the late 70s, and Ian Paisley was holding a protest meeting about something or other on a bridge across the Laggan. Suddenly, he pointed a quivering finger down at me, telling the crowd that I was the woman from Jack Lynch's radio. He might as well have wrapped me in a tricolour. The crowd began to mutter, and from the back the cry went up, into the river, into the river. I grabbed my colleague, Anne McCarty of The Guardian, and we both pushed up near the stage where we could be seen by the Reverend Martin Smith. Martin was a hardline unionist, but not one who believed in throwing women into the river, even if one of them did work for Jack Lynch's radio. Back then, RTE was the nearest thing to a representative of the Irish state in the north because there was no official Irish government presence there. So we became a handy whipping boy for the more extreme unionists. Paisley would go into the BBC studios, but never in my time into RTE's. As a result, RTE reporters always had to interview him on the street, shouting above the noise of traffic. Paisley shouting back dismissive answers, playing to his delighted crowd of followers. Invoking the image of the drunken Irish, he snarled comments to male RTE reporters like, "Let me smell your breath." It made for lively television, as we discovered, and as Paisley knew very well. To be based in RTE's Northern office was to be at the cutting edge. And it was important that we were there. For most of us, it was the biggest Irish story we'd ever cover, but it was an international story as well. Hiding behind the shiny picture of modern Britain in the 60s with the Beatles and Mary Quant and the Open University and Harold Wilson's white heat of technology was the political slum which was Northern Ireland. There was a level of open discrimination against one community which would not be tolerated anywhere else in the United Kingdom. And in October 1968, an RTE cameraman, Gay O'Brien, filmed the RUC breaking up a peaceful civil rights march in Derry and brutally battening marchers, including Gerry Fitt MP and Eddie McAteer, leader of the Nationalist Party. That footage was broadcast all around the world. If ever one needed an argument for state support of an Irish public service broadcaster, there it was. Our Belfast office, in my time, was the whole top floor of Fannam House in Great Victoria Street, with a bird's eye view over the city. On days of bombings, we could pinpoint the locations by going out on the roof and looking for the columns of smoke. We were well staffed with brilliant cameramen like Nick O'Neill and the DC Brothers and Eugene McVeigh, legendary correspondents like Liam Howricken, who could walk into studio and do a live piece to camera without a note. And years later, like the tireless and knowledgeable Tommy Gorman, who must never have slept. Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act was invoked over the years to ban broadcasts, with, among other organisations, the Provisional IRA and Provisional Sinn Féin. My union, and most journalists, saw it as censorship, and there are those who thought it made it more difficult in the early 90s to bring the Provisional Republican movement away from violence and in from the political cold. Communications Minister Michael D. Higgins and his Taoiseach Albert Reynolds ended the broadcasting ban on the Provisionals in January 1994. All the rest of that year, there was endless speculation. Would the IRA call a ceasefire? We were all starting to give up hope when, one weekend in August 1994, RTE's Northern correspondent David Davenport, not a man to fly kites, came on the radio and said cautiously that he thought it was going to happen. For the first time, I believed that it would. Why? Because RTE's Northern correspondent said so. Today, with the atomization of media, with the choice of so many ways of listening and watching, it's extraordinary to remember how dominant RTE was. My dad, who was a baker, knew there was no point in trying to deliver bread and cakes at lunchtime on a Tuesday or a Thursday because there'd be a note on the door of the shop, closed for the Kennedys of Castle Ross. That was Radio Éireann's long-running soap opera, which ended in 1975. Visiting my brothers at boarding school in the 60s, all of us sitting outside on a Sunday afternoon, you'd hear from every car around you Micheál O'Hare's match commentary. Collecting my child from school in the 80s at about 2 o'clock, I'd hear the voice of Liveline presenter Marion Finucane from every car parked outside. And then there were the children's programmes. My daughter loved Bosco and raced home to see it after school. One day I noticed that she'd closed the curtains before she sat down to watch. When I asked why, she said, embarrassed, that she was a bit old now to be looking at Bosco and she didn't want the other kids to see her. So I hunkered down on a cushion and I watched it with her. 'Cause I loved Bosco too.
On this morning's programme, we heard A Flash of Pink by Felicity Hayes McCoy. From the Miscellany Archive, The Greatest by the late J.M. Dolan. Portrait of the Artist as a Young Smart Aleck by Gerard Stembridge. The Magic Box by Margaret Galvin. One for Everybody in the Audience by John Toll, also from the recent archive. And finally, A Bird's Eye View by Olivia O'Leary. The music was Pretty Flamingo by Manfred Mann, Stand By Me sung by Cassius Clay, Sound and Vision by David Bowie, Puff the Magic Dragon by Peter, Paul and Mary, and To Whom It Concerns by Chris Andrews. Felicity Hayes McCoy's latest novel is Once a Year, published by Hachette. And this Thursday, the 15th of January, there will be live broadcasts from the GPO across RTE Radio 1, 2FM, Lyric FM and Radio na Gaeltachta to officially launch the 100th year of public broadcasting in Ireland. You can find out more at rte.ie/100. And Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.